Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you. We're on record, and I'm going to need some help with this. Is it Papin? Papin? Very well. At this time, we're on record in Papin versus Papin, matters before the court for oral argument. On behalf of the appellant, Jerry Papin, Marty Anderson will argue, and on behalf of the respondent, Veronica Papin, John Cutler will argue. Are there any preliminary matters? Very well, you may proceed, sir.
Chief Justice Burdick, fellow justices, may it please the court. Your honors, thank you for hearing this matter. This is an important case not only for my client, but also for family law practitioners as it presents an opportunity for the court to clarify the law in a couple of key areas in domestic relations. This appeal stems from an intermediate appeal of the district court following a bench trial before the magistrate on an underlying divorce case. The purpose of the appeal is to set aside the lower court's erroneous rulings regarding the division of property and debt and to correct and clarify the true nature of Mr. Papin's separate property business. This appeal is not about Jerry wanting to do harm to Veronica or somehow revisit her. His issues with the underlying decisions are that they grant Veronica everything that he ever owned, one half of it. The court's decisions, in essence, ignore that he had a life before he was married to Veronica. He is and has always been willing to give her fair share of the community property. The standard of review set forth in Losser and carried out in Paleo is important in this case because this court is, as you are aware, procedurally bound to affirm or reverse the district court. And in this case, because it involves summary judgment, the court will also have to review the summary judgment record to decide if there was substantial and competent evidence to support the magistrate's findings in that regard. There's obviously a lot of issues before the court this morning. I'll focus on a few that are very important to my client and to the case in the time that I have allotted to me. The most significant issue with the district court's decision regarding the document known as the covenant is the court's decision in the Chavez versus Barras case that the covenant was invalid because it did not include the complete mailing address of the grantee. In issuing that decision, the district court relied upon that opinion and what I believe was dictum quoted by the court in reviewing the statute. The complete mailing address does appear in Idaho Code 55601. However, a careful review of Idaho Code 32917 merits a different result. 32917 says that marital settlement agreements have to be signed, essentially, and acknowledged in a like manner to real property transactions. And that's set forth in 55601. Like manner meaning a similar manner, not the exact manner. In our reply brief, we also pointed the court out the location of the comma. And that, I think, is a key part of the statute. Because when it says the comma is inserted there, the parenthetical phrase refers to the manner in which the signature must be acknowledged and notarized. And I think that is a key holding here. And the district court erred in making the determination that the complete mailing address is required of the grantee spouse. As we alluded to in our brief, if the court were to hold that the district court were correct in that, I do believe it unleashes a parade of horribles because not very many settlement agreements, in fact, have complete mailing addresses. Respondent points out that in the Chavez case that Mr. Barras' address was included, but he was not the grantee of the settlement agreement. Ms. Chavez was. She was the grantee that, pursuant to the terms of the settlement agreement, agreed to give the house to Mr. Barras. And so she was not the grantee, and her address appears nowhere in that document. So I think that's a key issue for the court to consider, and we would urge the court to rule that the district court erred in making that decision. The other issue that the district court brought up was the issue of consideration as between what it perceived to be the two signatories to the covenant, that being Adam and Veronica. Adam and Veronica are the spouses of Jerry and Melissa, who are the partners in the enterprise known as Straight Line Investment Group. They were the only signatories of the original document. When the agreement was presented to me at some time later in the proceedings, I did point that out to Jerry that this may become an issue. And on February 17, 2015, they did sign an acknowledgement prior to anybody bringing that up. Now, it's true that Ms. Gaffney, on behalf of Veronica, had already filed a motion for summary judgment, but they'd never raised that issue, and it certainly wasn't some sleight of hand we were trying to infer. And I don't think that two signatures are required of the covenant. And that's based on Idaho Code 32906, subparent 2. We believe that document is an instrument of conveyance. As this court ruled in Chavez, and looking at that settlement agreement, and the other cases we pointed out in our briefing, an instrument of conveyance does not need to have the word convey. Chavez used the word distribute. Other cases have used similar language that would present the same concept as passing title. We think that's why only one signature is required. The magistrate in part looked at the Uniform Prenuptial Act at 32921 in ruling on the covenant to talk about unconscionability. That act, we contend, is inapplicable to the case at bar. And that's because the legislature specifically defined in 32921 that it applied to prenuptial agreements specifically.
But isn't it instructive to know that the legislature said that there didn't have to be consideration for a prenup, and the legislature hasn't spoken on whether consideration has to be present for a marriage settlement?
Your Honor, I do believe that it is instructive in part that the legislature, but those acts are obviously passed at two different times and based upon two separate bodies of law.
But we recognize that the legislature knows what it's speaking of when it speaks.
Yes, Your Honor.
And they didn't say for a marriage settlement that we waive the requirement of consideration.
They did not, Your Honor. That is correct.
So isn't the implication that consideration would be required for a marriage settlement?
From the Idaho statutes, Idaho Code 32906, consideration, as you're aware, it's completely silent as to that. The omission of it, I can't infer one way or the other. This court has clarified the issue of consideration in some regards when it talked about Bliss and Hall and Sukan. And there's an error in my briefing that I noticed as I was preparing. I cited that body of case laws to say that consideration was not required. What I meant to say was not always required. Because there are other cases like Barrett and Wolford where the court does not mention consideration specifically, but I would acknowledge for this court today that Bliss and Hall and Sukan, those deeds did reference consideration in the instrument of conveyance. To answer your question, Justice Stenger, consideration, I think, is a part of every ordinary contract agreement. When the issue was raised sua sponte by the magistrate, Mr. Pappin came forward with a supplemental affidavit indicating that he and Melissa, as consideration for the covenant, had given themselves raises, and they had funneled more money into their community estates. Also, on page 3 of the covenant itself, which is page 277 of the record, they indicate that there were a number of other factors that the spouses kind of indicated, I think, can pass for consideration. That they didn't want to interfere with the ongoing business. They didn't want to interfere with the expansion of the business, implicitly recognizing the benefit that the business conveyed on the communities. But in any context, I think the issue of consideration is at root a factual question. And in this case, the magistrate did not construe the record most favorably to Jerry Pappin. To the contrary, whenever there was a factual dispute, she nearly uniformly construed the record in favor of Veronica, and that's an error. The Intermountain Forest Management versus Louisiana Pacific case talks about the competing motions for summary judgment and how the court should apply the standard. Even when Jerry's defending against the magistrate's sua sponte issues, he is on the defense in summary judgment, and the consideration as a question of fact should have been construed in his favor. The magistrate made no analysis of that. Instead, she focused on the consideration between what she perceived to be the two signatories to the covenant, which is Adam and Veronica. And therefore, the issue has really never been decided, and certainly not based on substantial and competent evidence. And we therefore believe it was error for the district court to uphold the magistrate's grant of summary judgment. There were other examples.
Go ahead.
There were other examples of the court straying from the factual record. She relied upon, for example, a statement that the business was worth $600,000 as a finding of fact in summary judgment, which was never presented. She talked about Veronica's inability to understand, read, and write the English language. The only thing that was mentioned in the summary judgment affidavits was that Veronica was a Czech national and spoke English as a second language. If there was an inference at all to be drawn about the ability to understand and comprehend the document as a factual proposition, that should have been resolved in Jerry's favor in defending summary judgment against Veronica. Also, as a matter of law, that should have been construed in Jerry's favor because of the Erwin Rogers case we cited in our brief. People that sign a contract have a duty to read and understand the agreement they signed, and Veronica did. She signed it unequivocally. Remember, and I will direct this court to that, was her defense on summary judgment. Not that she didn't understand it, not that it was unfair, not that she never had an opportunity to talk to an attorney, but she'd never seen it. She didn't recall signing it. First she said she never saw it, then she backdated and said, that may be my signature, but I don't recall signing the document. So all the arguments and the findings the magistrate made that the district court relied upon in affirming were an error, because having painted herself into that corner of feigned ignorance, this is similar to the Liebelt case, where Mrs. Liebelt said that she didn't understand a prenuptial agreement, that it was unconscionable. It's very nearly the same fact pattern here. But if you read the covenant, and the fact that Jerry was overseas on duty in Afghanistan, had absolutely no opportunity to coerce her. She had the covenant for over a week. She had the covenant repeatedly advises her to seek the opportunity to avail herself of the legal advice of counsel. For all of those reasons, Your Honors, we believe that the covenant should have been upheld as a valid agreement. Even after the court ruled that it was not a proper agreement, we raised it at trial and again at the lower court, asking the courts to give some effect to it. The job of the courts in this context is to give effect to those contractual agreements the parties reach. And here, the covenant is, it's as if it doesn't exist. At a very minimum, we said that it should have had the intention, it should have evidenced the intention to maintain the separate property estate by Veronica acknowledging by her signature that Jerry's business was the separate property.
What's the effect of re-raising the issue at trial as it relates to the summary judgment agreement?
Well, if this court or the lower courts were to find that it's not a valid marital settlement agreement because of whatever technical reason it's not, it's still a statement on Veronica's behalf that she acknowledges Jerry's business was his separate property. It's evidence to overcome the burden of production on somebody under 32903 and the relevant case law is to prove that the separate property is in fact their separate property. Signing that document, saying that it is separate property, Veronica saying it is separate property, we think is pretty critical evidence for the court to consider in bolstering Jerry's testimony that the business was, in fact, his separate property. That's why we think it's important, Your Honor.
And what evidence is there that the judge didn't consider that?
Wasn't addressed in either decision. It's hard to prove a negative, but we raised it, they ignored it. And therefore, by ignoring that evidence, I think that is error because it did not weigh the competing evidence. It only considered the evidence favorable to where the magistrate wanted to go. But we think that's the error. The next issue I'd like to discuss with the court is the nature of Jerry's business because it's confusing. And it's something the magistrate didn't grasp. It's something the district court didn't grasp. And I don't know how we can explain it differently. Jerry began his business as a financial consultant in 1991. He worked for a predecessor to Ameriprise. Edward Jones is my 401k firm, so that's who I'll equate it to. But so he worked at one of those firms, Charles Schwab, Edward Jones, Ameriprise. He worked in that industry, and he began to gather a client list. the asset that Jerry acquired as a separate property, as we pointed out under the Wood case, is that client list. The business is that separate property asset. And he carried that throughout his life and his career, and that's how he makes money. The client list was never transferred to any entity and never has been, nor can it be. The client list is made up of people that he has those business relationships with. And this court has attempted on several occasions to try and carve out this notion of personal goodwill. Justice Eisman wrote a couple of pretty good dissents in Stewart, and I can't remember the name of the other case, but he hinged upon, you know, what is personal goodwill and what's the business goodwill. And this court has acknowledged in Wolford and its progeny that there seemed to be this idea that personal goodwill is not community property. The personal attributes, the skill, knowledge, expertise, no more than the beauty of your statute or stature of a person can be dealt with as personal property. In Stewart, when Justice Horton, when he was a magistrate, when he valued the dermatology business, the CPA that he relied upon talked about there was a distinction between personal goodwill and business goodwill. But then they never really carved it out. That CPA just said it's $210,000 as goodwill. And Justice Eisman, in his dissent, pointed out there's an issue with that, because we acknowledge this is not a community asset capable of being divided. We acknowledge that it exists, but they never put a dollar figure on it. Chandler is the other case. Rex Chandler, in his restaurant business, they acknowledge the same thing when they valued the restaurant business, that Rex Chandler, like Dr. Stewart, had a high earning capacity. He was better than your average whatever he was, and that was personal goodwill, not divisible by the court. But they didn't parse that out. That touches upon the issue with Jerry's case. Now, I'll admit that in this case, the magistrate never really said how she valued the business. In Exhibit A, in her decision, she pops in $105,000, which comes from the operating agreement 2 years before. In the paragraph leading up to the decision that she didn't announce, she did the math that's called for by the operating agreement, minus the cost of the individual owner-operator, like Chandler, like Stewart, and she came up with the business should have been worth $1,300. But then in her decision, in the schedule, in the spreadsheet, she announced the business was worth $105,000.
Which is what your client and his partner agreed to sell to the other four.
As he testified at trial, Your Honor, he was about to go to Afghanistan. The operating agreement actually has a phrase that says it's this value in the event of death or disability. As he was about to go into harm's way for our country, he and his business partner sat down and updated the buy-sell agreement. They also included a formula which the magistrate did not adhere to. And what Chandler says, although the court does have broad discretion in determining the value of the business, once it picks a method, and here the magistrate didn't, the Hall case from Washington State that's referenced in Chandler seems to indicate there's a buy-sell methodology, although the magistrate here never announced that. The district court never affirmed that was the methodology she used. They talk about that being an acceptable method, but the buy-sell clause here should not be construed to set the value of the business. That was between those two people and an investment company, and it is not the fair market value that Chandler requires.
Why would a figure that would be used in the event of death, though, not be applicable? In probate law, we typically have to revert to community property, separate properties like this, community property and separate property principles like this. So why wouldn't the contract that talks about death also not be applicable in divorce?
For the very reason that Justice Eisman touches upon in his dissents in Stewart and in Chandler, and that is this implicit buy-sell agreement or the lack thereof. Because in the event that Jerry was killed in combat, Melissa did not have a competing entity. Or if Melissa got hit by a car, Jerry would not have a competing entity. Between those two individuals, that may have been a fair market value because there was no non-compete. If Veronica, not this, I know this is cliche, but Veronica could have that business for $105,000 every day of the week because Jerry will go next door and open up a competing business with his personal attributes and skill, and her business becomes worth nothing. So it's not a fair market value, Your Honor. Nobody would buy into Jerry's business without Jerry's relationship. That's the error committed by the magistrate court. And it's important to note that this this issue with the business. So there's the concept of the client list, which is really what Jerry refers to as the business. And then there's the LLC. Now, I can see, absent the covenant, that the LLC, formed in 2011, is community property. It was formed during the marriage. The presumption would apply. Absent the covenant saying it's separate property, no problem. But SLG is not worth $105,000 because, contrary to what the magistrate and the district court held, these AUMs or client assets or the client list itself, they were never transferred. These are free, independent people like all of us. They invest in a platform. SLG is not a federal regulated platform with a trust account that can house $16 million worth of investment funds. That's held by TD. That's Jerry's current platform that he has a business relationship with, that those investment people have an independent business relationship with. And so the magistrate erred in deciding that Jerry transferred 15% into SLG. Never happened. And this is also evidenced by the sale to Britton Webb. Mr. Webb did not buy a portion of Jerry's then-existing LLC, JPSS.
But how can you say that the AUMs have no impact on the value of the company, that it's just the client list? I mean, if you look at the agreement between Britton Webb and your client, where the sale price goes down depending upon the AUMs, it's clearly tied to the AUMs.
In that context, Justice Brody, you are correct. Given the fact that those were two employees, if you will, or franchisees in this Edward Jones context, would I leave my broker at Edward Jones if another guy, if he retired or something like that? I'm very likely to stay at Edward Jones just because it's a pain to move somewhere else. In that context, with those ties to that goodwill of that national brokerage, that AUM valuation, because that's how that construct values the client list, that's fair. But where Jerry walked out of that and became an independent IRA, he became an independent advisor, that goodwill no longer applies. Those clients are not going to sell. So this also touches upon goodwill, Your Honor, because goodwill is the probability that a client will stay, right?
But my impression of that industry is that people like your client value their work, their business, based on the assets, the value of the assets that they are managing. There are certain folks who operate in the same realm that your client does who won't even consider taking on a new client unless they are bringing in a certain level of assets to be under their management. I mean, I just don't see how you can divorce the, I'm going to call it the book of business, because I'm grasping for a quick descriptor.
I think that phrase was used at the trial.
So the book of business matters.
Your Honor, in that construct of the Webb transaction, you're absolutely correct. In any other construct, it simply has no relation. Justice Eisman, again, in his dissent, talking about Dr. Stewart's practice, touched upon attorneys. You know, and since we're all lawyers, that's a great way for us. You know, what would your personal injury practice be if I were to buy it from you and you weren't there? What would it be worth? I mean, it's your name when you were in private practice. It's your personality, your skill, your experience, everything. That's what brings value to that entity of Brody Law. When you're gone, it ceases. That's why attorneys don't sell practices.
But the compensation is based on the amount of assets under management.
Your Honor, that's a mistake that was prevalent throughout the testimony.
Well, you better disabuse me of it, because I think that's a fairly pronounced way to look at the company and the value of the business.
Jerry's compensation isn't directly tied to the AUMs in any mathematical formula. Every client is different. David Smith pointed that out in his testimony, which was disregarded by the magistrate.
But it's between 1% and 2%, as I understand it.
It varies by client.
Right.
That was David Smith's analogy, that, you know, a 20-year-old with $100,000 has a completely different worth and earning stream than an 80-year-old with $100,000. They're different clients, and you can't just apply a mathematical percentage, because they may invest differently, the longevity of the client is different.
But that's how the compensation is based, on a percentage of the assets under management.
Your Honor, I Respectfully, I don't think that appears in the record, that that's how it's... David Smith talked about the AUMs being a key performance indicator, but there was never testimony that it was directly tied. At some level, in a common sense, sure. Does my Edward Jones broker make money based upon how much money I have there and how I'm invested? Absolutely. That's common sense. But there's no tie in value in the business here, nor, and ultimately, Your Honor, at the end of the day, this AUM thing is a red herring, other than the magistrate determined that because Jerry couldn't trace the AUMs, that the presumption of community property applied. And that, you know, but they're different things. What if Jerry had two clients and one of them had $50 million and they passed away and that estate, you know, deeded out? Would that have anything to do with the community efforts to enhance the value of his business? No. Would the market crash have anything to do with the effort to enhance his business? No. They're just separate things. I've gone over my time.
Just one last question. In reading through both the magistrate's decision, which was a lengthy, thorough decision, and the district court's decision, they appeared to continually come back to the idea that this was really a failure of record keeping on the part of your client, that there wasn't the ability to trace, and therefore they were going to draw inferences in favor of community property, and felt like that was the proper way to do it. Do you want to address the idea that this is really your client's fault for a failure of record keeping?
Thank you, Your Honor. So this is where we talk about the Hobson's choice of the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act and the duty, the federal obligation that Jerry has not to disclose the financial information. And so Jerry had to provide a redacted list that the magistrate found to be not credible. You know, she ignored all of Veronica's credibility concerns about submitting false documents and lying allegedly about the affair. But with my client, she found him not to be credible and decided that these redacted lists were made up, despite the fact that those same lists were used 4 years prior in facilitating the written web sale. What Jerry did to create the redacted list is he downloaded from the Ameriprise platform the client list and its date of acquisition, and he downloaded from his current TD the names and account numbers and the value of the assets, and then he redacted the names and came up with a code like any doctor's office would do. But he could not fully disclose, and what were we to do? Were we to parade 200 clients in there and say, yep, Jerry's my guy and I started in 1991? That too would violate federal law. So we did the best we could.
While we're talking about your client's credibility, would you please address the status of his license and to what extent, I mean, I want to make sure that I fully hear from you
what
the evidence shows.
Again, Your Honor, this, I think, was something, it was a strategy employed by plaintiff's counsel that unfortunately turned out to be effective in undermining Jerry's credibility. But essentially, when Jerry was with Ameriprise, they're regulated by an association, not any government agency, known as FINRA. And FINRA is I don't even know who to equate it to, the Realtors Association, although I think there might be some government ties here in Idaho to that, but the Bar Association, but of course there's ties to the government here. But FINRA is truly a private group of broker-dealers that have their own club. When Jerry left Ameriprise, he was no longer part of the club. In fact, they submitted to him and gave him a U-5 form, which we submitted into evidence, that gave him a clean bill of health, said, no issues, check it off. Jerry then entered into a dispute with Ameriprise because he didn't think he got the compensation, and that went tit for tat. And then 2 years later, while he was in Afghanistan, they sent notice that he was going to be censured. The way that the court construed it, and Veronica construed it, was that in 2011, all of this was happening and Jerry had a fire sale. But look at the date of the default decision. Jerry was in Afghanistan, and it was 2 years after the Britton Webb sale. It's a total red herring. Jerry was somewhat cavalier in his testimony, saying that he didn't care about FINRA because he doesn't work in that broker-dealer world. It's not like passing the Bar Association. He does not need to be licensed with FINRA to trade. He can go get licensed with the state of Idaho today. He doesn't want to do that. That's part of downsizing his practice.
Well, the inference, at least that I understood, and so please clear it up, was that the sale to his partner was all about not being able to be licensed. Am I correct? Am I reading the record right? That's how it was interpreted?
You are reading the record correct, and that's how the magistrate and Veronica construed it. But that is not what actually happened. And the most telling thing I can tell you is look at the dates. That's the objective fact. The Britain web sale was 2011. The censure was in 2013. Two completely different incongruent events. And also, look at the dates of Jerry's deployment. Because Jerry's testimony is that he didn't know he was censured. When they mailed him the certified document saying, if you don't respond, we're going to censure you, he was in Afghanistan serving our country. He didn't find out about the default decision until Veronica gave it to him in discovery in the divorce the next year. But he doesn't care about it because he doesn't work in the FINRA world. He could go get licensed with the Idaho Department of Finance today. All right, that's all the time I have. Thank you.
Thank you. On behalf of the respondent.
May it please the court. It's fitting that this case is being heard in Pocatello, home of my mentor and friend Judge Randy Smith. You don't have to be around Judge Smith long to know that for him, and I know for this court as well, the standard of review is among the most important issues in deciding an appellate case. Here, the standard of review resolves 9 out of the 10 issues in Veronica's favor. The 10th, regarding the disputed covenant, was correctly decided by both the magistrate judge and the district court. My colleague, Mr. Anderson, points to record evidence favorable to his client and asked this court to reverse. But this court isn't tasked with deciding whether the Pate court could have decided in his client's favor. On factual and discretionary matters, this court has recognized a more limited role. The court's decisions counsel that factual findings will be affirmed so long as the record reasonably supports them. And discretionary matters will be affirmed if the district court recognized its discretion and acted reasonably within the bounds of law. Unless the court has specific questions, I'd like to address the factual and discretionary issues first and then turn to the covenant. The first matter that I'd like to address is the 2011 sale of the business and the finding that the proceeds of that sale were community property. That finding is premised on 2 important factual decisions by the district court. Both of those are found at the augmented record, pages 47 to 48, paragraph 129. The first factual finding is that the abstracts of client lists, the supposed dates of acquisition, and the dollar amounts at issue were records prepared by Jerry Patton. They were not third-party business records in some redacted form, but they were records prepared by the client, Jerry. And that finding is supported by trial transcript record 369, starting at line 17 and continuing on to page 370, line 11, where there's a dialogue with Mr. Pappin about the production of those records. And he states that they came from him on his computer or a drive and him doing manipulation with those documents. So these aren't third-party business records. These were records prepared by Mr. Pappin. That's the first factual finding. It's important on the whether the sale proceeds are community property. The second factual finding is that Mr. Pappin's testimony and his production of the documents was not credible. The documents were not reliable. That's also found the same paragraph 129 at 47 and 48 of the augmented record. And that finding is not only found at that part of the augmented record, but the court makes credibility findings about Mr. Pappin's testimony at other places in the record. At AR 6, note 2, and AR, I mean the augmented record, AR 11, paragraph 28, AR 16, paragraphs 43 and 45, AR 17, paragraph 49, AR 20, paragraph 57, AR 35, paragraphs 88 and 92, and AR 47, paragraph 129. This court will not disturb the credibility findings of the trier of fact. We liberally construe the record in favor of those findings, and each of those findings is factually supported. There was an independent mental health analyst who, with respect to the custody issues, analyzed both of the parties and found certain things with respect to Jerry and his personality, that he would say things and present them in a way that was beneficial to him, and omit things that wouldn't be as favorable in the district court. If those paragraphs that I've identified notes him doing that in his testimony before the court. So the credibility findings are supported by the record, and they're the basis for the court's decision that the proceeds of the sale were community property. Because the sale occurred in 2011, and the proceeds were received during that time frame. So Jerry had an obligation to show that the proceeds of that sale, that community receipt of the money during the marriage, was separate property. This isn't an issue. The issue before the court is not whether Jerry had a separate business in 1991. The issue before the court is whether the business sold in 2011 was a separate property business. And that's the issue on which the court found Jerry was unable to meet his burden of proof because of he prepared the records and there was a credibility issue with respect to those records and whether they were reliable. His expert relied on his records, and the district court found that and therefore couldn't rely on the expert testimony. There's another matter that's come up with respect to whether the magistrate judge was going outside the record and making findings contrary to Jerry, or that the credibility findings should be disregarded because the magistrate judge had some form of bias. This comes up with respect to the use of the deposition. And so I'd just like to clarify the record that Jerry's full deposition was entered into the trial record, and so therefore was within the bounds for the court to consider. At transcript 397-7-25, the deposition was offered to be published and incorporated in the trial record, and there was a request to opposing counsel about whether there was an objection to that. There was no objection. And that would be proper. Admitting the full deposition would be permissible under the Family Law Rules of Procedure 440, requiring an objection to oppose admission of a deposition, Family Law Rules of Procedure 439A, allowing any allowable purpose a deposition can be used for. And in this case, the deposition is a statement of a party opponent under Idaho Rule of Evidence 802. So the credibility findings of the district court and the factual findings about the preparation of the records resolve the issue of whether the proceeds of the sale were community property. Because there's a statutory presumption that the district court recognized that money received during the marriage is community property. There was a finding that there was not evidence to support a contrary finding, and so the evidence was deemed community property under the presumption. Moving next to the valuation of the Straight Line Investments Group, Chandler versus Chandler suggests that the courts have discretion in valuing businesses. It's a difficult job to value small businesses with few employees, assets that are hard to define sometimes. And the district court found, and the magistrate was appropriately exercised that discretion. Valued Straight Line according to the operating agreement between the parties. In this case, that's really the best evidence we have. Jerry testified that the amount was correct. At trial transcript 423.15 to 424.9, Jerry confirmed the values in the operating agreement they were correct as of that time. There wasn't any other evidence or better evidence from which the court could have made that finding. So the finding with respect to the value was supported by the record. With respect to the issue of reimbursement, I think that matter is somewhat premature. The district court remanded the reimbursement issue because the magistrate judge said it had given the burden of proof to the wrong party. The issue on appeal before this court is relates to the legal issue, the legal standard that should apply. And I think with respect to the property taxes, I think there's case law from this court in Swanson versus Swanson and Schoblane versus Schoblane that says that property taxes can be considered for reimbursement. And with respect to the record on that point, there was no objection to the expert's use of the property tax public information data. The only objection was to the allowance of the expert opinion testimony. And again, that opinion is a matter within the district court's discretion to decide whether to allow an expert to testify on something. And the district court here found that the underlying facts and the issue were acknowledged and put into the record by both parties, and the opinion The evidentiary issue simply went to the weight of what should be given to that opinion. So there isn't a basis to find an abuse of discretion in allowing that opinion to be offered.
Before you move on to the next topic, let's talk for just a minute about the kind of the procedural way that I think our rules work. So the district court's decision on appeal became final and, of course, was appealable to this court. Where the district court had an order to remand on the issue, on an issue, would it make more sense in a perfect world to have that remand take place before the appeal comes up here? So that is to say that our court is looking at all of the issues in their final form rather than now we're reviewing an issue that isn't quite final because the magistrate court hasn't acted yet?
Your Honor, with respect to the reimbursement issue, I mean, I do think that there's a basis, and I'm admittedly new to this case. Charles McNally joined our firm this summer, and so I was here to argue it. So I was involved in the briefing, but in reviewing, I did have some concerns that the reimbursement issue, not the entire appeal, may be premature because it's possible that applying the proper burden of proof, that the magistrate court will find there isn't a basis for reimbursement. We don't know yet. So it may be premature for this court to address issues with respect to the disputed legal questions on whether property taxes count or not, or whether or not there's abuse of discretion in admitting certain evidence or not admitting it, because on remand, the burden of proof may change some of that. It may not.
Well, I'm just wondering if maybe we need to look at our rules in that regard in terms of when issues become appealable, if there's a partial remand.
Right.
To the magistrate court.
It has the flavor of an interlocutory appeal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right, and that's an issue I'm not 100% sure on whether that particular issue, I think, might be premature. I think the rest of the issues are final and decided and are right for review by this court.
Thank you.
Moving from the reimbursement issue to the asset division table, one of the arguments is that the district court improperly divided certain assets because the exhibits were demonstrative rather than actually admitted into evidence. Here, you know, that issue was really created by the parties' failure to follow the court's order in coordinating on their exhibit and getting it into the record in the first instance. And so it's a little bit hard to fault the magistrate court for who has a statutory duty under Idaho Code 37.712.1 to, which says the community property must be assigned by the court to, you know, put the court in between a rock and a hard place, where it has a statutory duty to assign property to each of the parties that it knows about, and there's clearly evidence in the record and the parties produced information that suggested these assets existed, and then to say that, well, because we failed as parties to, you know, agree on all of this completely, that the court then has to, can't make a reasonable decision. So I think that's a little bit of a waiver issue, I think, on the part of Jerry Papin with respect to objecting to the informality of the evidence when it was his own, when there was a statutory duty to divide it and a fault by the parties in not doing that. But beyond that, I don't think that it really makes a difference in this case. There's an argument that the equalization payment is somehow based on the assets in the table. But if you look at the table, nothing in the table of significant value is really divided one way or the other. There's a bunch of household things that are sent one way or the other. Everything of any significant value is divided 50-50, so that wouldn't affect or adjust the equalization payment. And there's really not a base. And the only significant assets did have record evidence. The two cars, for example, had exhibits in the record supporting their value. The valuation of the business was an issue where there was record evidence and that was decided. So anything of significance was properly and competently decided by the district court, and the rest of this stuff is just household items that don't really go one way or the other, and there's no real basis to remand simply to address those issues. More importantly, perhaps, with respect to the equalization payment, the only real basis in the record that supports the equalization payment is the valuation of that straight line. $105,000 assigned to Jerry is really the biggest, you know, difference between the two parties in what they received. And if you divided that by half and looked at what the equalization payment actually was, equalization payment is less than half of the straight line property. So adding in the things in the exhibit that were allegedly not based on enough evidence actually reduces the equalization payment and benefits Jerry, and so wouldn't be a basis for him to complain on appeal. Moving then to the issue of the grounds for divorce, the record amply supports the district court's findings. There's a very high standard of proof with respect to finding a grounds for divorce. The standard is clear and convincing evidence. And it not only has to be clear and convincing evidence that adultery happened, but that it was the cause for the divorce. And the record is clear. The district court and the magistrate judge both reviewed the record and found that the irreconcilable differences rationale was properly supported. And the testimony in the record supports the court's conclusion that really neither party had met their burden with respect to the specific grounds raised, and the best rationale was just that there was irreconcilable differences. 905 to 917 is Veronica's testimony about cruelty. Transcript 965 to 967, she denies the affair. Transcript 1050, lines 9 to 14, is the third-party witness testimony about Jerry's abuse. And transcript 1249, lines 5 to 8, is Jeremy's testimony about not having any intimacy for 8 years. And so looking at the record, it was a clear basis that the district court and the magistrate judge had for concluding that this was just a divorce that happened, irreconcilable differences. It's the basis for that, and the party met their burden on the grounds of divorce. So it was not error for the district court to find or affirm the magistrate court's factual findings and conclusions with respect to the grounds for the divorce. And that goes directly into the maintenance issue, because one of the main reasons for objecting to maintenance is that the district court allegedly didn't consider this adultery, which the record doesn't show that the district court found that the adultery happened one way or the other. It recites the evidence from both sides, and so I don't know that there's a basis to fault the district court on its finding with respect to the maintenance.
Isn't that a fairly stringent standard to prove the necessity of maintenance?
It's a discretionary issue, and there are two legal prerequisites that the district court must consider. And here the district court considered those legal prerequisites at AR 57, paragraph 180, and made a finding with respect to those two issues. There was additional factual findings related to maintenance at the augmented record, pages 40 to 41, the memorandum decision, paragraphs 108 to 116. So certainly there are a number of factors that the magistrate judge must review and analyze. But this court has held that the decision to award spousal maintenance and the amount thereof is committed to the trial court's sound discretion.
But isn't the trial court determined that Veronica needs those assets in retirement, and is that the question that's presented?
Well, so the question is whether or not she has sufficient property to provide for her reasonable needs. I don't know if there's a time frame in question about in the statute or in the case law with respect to what those needs are and whether or not the needs can include retirement needs. The record supports that Veronica is unskilled. She doesn't have education and ability to obtain a profession that will meet her needs at the moment.
That's the second part of the test.
I think it goes to both. What are the reasonable needs? The sufficient property.
But it's a conjunctive test. She has to prove that she doesn't have the property to maintain to reasonably maintain herself, and she has to prove that she's unemployed.
And I guess I think they inform each other in the sense that if in order to know whether I have enough property, I have to know enough property for what, and the for what is to maintain a certain living standard given my skills. I mean, the two tests are separate, but they're also interrelated.
Is there a case law to suggest that we look towards someone's retirement as far as the property maintenance is concerned?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of case law one way or the other on that issue. I don't know that this court has decided whether or not considering retirement is fair with respect to maintenance. But I would point the court to what the district court and the magistrate judge actually did in this case, which is award a very modest maintenance amount, talking about $750 a month is really net what she gets, $2,000 at the outset, but she has to reimburse $1,250 a month of that once she gets her disbursement of property. So in the short term, she's getting $2,000 a month when she doesn't have any of the assets distributed. And then once the assets are distributed, she has to pay back, you know, from deducted from what she receives, $1,250 a month of that. And it was a two-year period, so a short time frame. I think she was married shortly, you know, after the divorce finalized. So we're really talking about a very, very modest award, and I think it was the district court's discretion, even if it considered a factor that this court hasn't specifically condoned, would not, it didn't abuse its discretion in its overall finding on the matter. That would be my answer for your question. Moving to the issue of attorney fees.
Mr. Keller, I think you better move to covenant because that's a big issue.
Fair enough. I'm happy to go through over the covenant. I'd start by saying I think that it's not as big an issue given that, I mean, the biggest asset in this is that was the sale of the business, the $504,000, you know, which was reduced to $367,000 sale of the business, which the court found was community property. A portion of that went to this straight line group. So I think we're dealing with, even if the covenant is valid, it wouldn't be a disclaimer as to the full amount, but only as to an interest in the $105,000 value of the business. But on that specific point, I think that the district court correctly affirmed the magistrate judge's decision that summary judgment was warranted. And the courts have kind of struggled with this, and they've engaged in various rationales for what this covenant is and why it isn't valid. But it's really not that complicated.
I'm struggling with is, should she have, she, the magistrate, should have granted summary judgment on the issue as opposed to having heard the facts as it related to that?
And the answer is yes, Your Honor. The summary judgment is warranted because the four corners of the document demonstrate that it's not an agreement with Jerry Pappin, and so it's therefore not an agreement that he can enforce or an agreement that could be considered as a marital covenant. At record 514 in the supplemental briefing on summary judgment, our client argued that the document was not a valid marriage settlement agreement because it was not an agreement between Jerry and Veronica. And it's as simple as that. The parties to the agreement were Adam and Veronica, the two spouses. Those were the parties. And the agreement at record, I think it's at various points in the record, but the copy I have is at record 314, makes very clear that there are only two parties to the agreement. And the reason that's clear is based on the language used in the agreement. On page 314, at various paragraphs, there's language like either, both, neither, either, words you can only use if there are two parties, one side and another. You don't use those words if you're talking about four parties. You usually use those words in the context of one person versus another. And you look at the document itself, and it says the signatories are the only people who were asked to sign the document at the time, and the only persons, therefore, who could have been contracting, even if there's going to be a contract, would have been Veronica and Adam. You also look at page 314 of the record, and it says that the parties agree that this covenant represents the whole of their agreement, that no other representations, warranties, promises, or covenants, oral or written, expressed or implied, have been made with regard to the issues herein described. So there's an integration clause, which says that, you know, the parties are the people to the agreement, no one else benefits from this. There's also a specific disclaimer that says, in witness thereof, the covenant shall be binding upon and inure to the benefit of the parties and their respective heirs, executors, and administrators. Jerry is not Veronica's heir. He's not Adam's heir. He's not an executor or an administrator. So Jerry's ability to bring the covenant and enforce it is foreclosed by the document itself. He's not a third-party beneficiary. There are no other agreements respecting this. And so though the courts kind of struggled and used various rationales, what they were really saying the entire time, in different ways of saying it, is that this isn't an agreement that's Jerry's to enforce. It's not a marital agreement between Jerry and Veronica.
Right, but let's go back to your standard of review. So the standard of review is we have to look at what the district court did, and the district court ruled that this covenant was unenforceable because it didn't have a mailing address. Was that correct or wrong?
With respect to the mailing address, you know, I think that two answers to your question. First, with respect to the mailing address issue specifically, I think there is a reason that you have to have identification sufficient of the grantee. And it goes back, it ties into what I've just been saying, which is that this Jerry's nowhere in this agreement. You know, there's no saying, I give Jerry Pappin X, Y, or Z. So the mailing address is the way the district court characterized it. But it's a greater deficiency in that it doesn't ever say that he's the recipient of anything. And so on the technical statutory issue, I think it's one premature. I don't know that this is the best case to resolve that issue. I think it's complicated whether you...
I doubt we're going to get this agreement in the future, but yeah, that's a different question.
Fair enough.
But does that make any sense to hinge your decision on 55601? Obviously, that statute had in mind real estate-type documents that are filed with the county recorder's office. And the reason a complete mailing address is there is because the assessor needs to know where to send the property tax bill. When you're dealing with a married couple, the necessity of a married couple including their complete mailing address for both of them when they're still living in the same residence just seems to be exalting form over substance.
I think, Your Honor, frankly, I think you're probably right. I'm not sure that those particular formalities would be always necessary or always required in this context, but this court can affirm. This court has to affirm or reverse the district court, but it can do so on alternative grounds. And so our primary arguments are that the court should review the document just like the magistrate court did and just like the district court did for whether or not it's a valid marital agreement. There were various reasons that were offered. Among them were that the parties were not the right parties. Another one was that there wasn't any consideration even recited in the agreement between Adam and Veronica, who were the parties. And I think that lack of recitation of consideration is important because I don't think there is any consideration between Veronica and Adam. So, I mean, on the statutory question that the district court kind of hung its hat on, I think it is potentially form over substance. But on the overall question of whether this is a valid agreement based on just the document itself, because I agree there are probably issues if you get into the formation questions about what did who say to whom about whether, you know, what was the effect of this and whether there was adequate, whether it's unconscionable or not. Those are probably fact issues that were outside of the proper consideration of the district court or the magistrate judge.
But haven't we held that promises made and accepted between two parties are in fact consideration if they're mentioned in the contract?
That's true, but I don't think there are any promises between Adam and Veronica in the contract that really...
will support consideration?
That's right. But even... The more important issue I would point the court to is the fact that Jerry is the one who's trying to enforce this and the contract by its own terms.
I understand the privity argument.
Yeah. So the consideration issue, I mean, I think it's a little bit of a stretch to find one of those promises in this between the relevant parties. It's possible that there is, but I think the privity is the main problem, and that was founded by the magistrate judge, and the district court identified that as an issue as well. And the
let's
court,
assume instead of we were talking about a business here, what if we were just talking about a piece of land? And if Veronica had signed a quitclaim deed with only her signature on it, how would the analysis be different than here?
Well, the question is to whom is the quitclaim deed addressed?
Quitclaimed it to her husband.
Then I think, you know, it does only require, so the signature issue is again one that I think it's correct that you probably only need a signature of the person against whom you're enforcing the document. But in this case, you do have to have at least the right parties. And in this case, there isn't the right parties. The document, is to Adam, not to Jerry, in this particular document. The other party, the grantee, if there is one, isn't Jerry.
Is Jerry's name not mentioned in the document at all?
Jerry's name is mentioned in the document, but it's not as a party. And as I mentioned on page 314 of the record, it identifies very clearly that there are no third-party beneficiaries. This is the entirety of the agreement, and the agreement is between the parties. So Jerry doesn't have a basis to come in and try to enforce this as a marital settlement agreement.
How do you read this document not to benefit the two partners? I mean, starting from the very first whereas clause and moving from there, I mean, it seems to me to be all about the benefit of Melissa Davis and Jerry Pappin.
There are certainly a lot of prefatory clauses to that effect, but if you look at the plain language of who the parties are, who may enforce it, on page 314 of the record, you know, the parties agree the covenant is enforceable, but between them, it says, should either party take any action, or the parties have signed and sealed, this covenant shall be binding upon and in order to the benefit of the parties. The parties is the key term in this case, and the parties is not ambiguous. It's Adam and it's Veronica, not Jerry. So, at most, even if the court, so if the court disregards those plain language arguments, I think you can look at what the way the district court treated those factual issues, and I think we know how the court would come out on those. Whether they're proper for summary judgment, I think is a little bit more of a tough. So the only one that I would say is that I think the court, as the prior fact, has the power to reach the most probable inference on those factual issues. And I don't think there's any record evidence to suggest that Jerry told Veronica what the value of Straight Line Investment Group was. And the court, I think, could make a probable inference finding that he didn't tell her that, and that would be material and would be a basis for an unconscionability finding as well.
But that would have to be a factual determination.
It could be a most probable inferences determination if the record is undisputed that he didn't tell her about the value. And that would be proper for summary judgment by the trier of fact.
Thank you. How much time does the appellant have?
Actually, has 20 seconds.
I'll give you a minute.
Come up and say hi.
I know exactly how I'm going to spend my minute. On page 43 of my reply brief, I made an accusation that the magistrate fabricated evidence. I'd like to apologize to this court for that sharp use of language. I did not intend that. Caught up in passion in writing the brief. What I meant to say was the magistrate included facts that were not present in the record. So my apologies to Judge Stanford and to this court for that inference, because that's a lack of decorum. Speaking very quickly now, presumption of the separate property business. The business was found to be a separate property business by the district court. That appears in his decision. And the presumption in the Wood versus Wood case, the guy that had the undertaker business, says that presumption of separate property continues. Therefore, the burden again was not on Jerry to prove that the community didn't have an interest. It was on Veronica to prove that it did. With regard to Justice Brody's question about whether we should redo the rules to take care of the remand, in the Stewart case, there was a similar situation.
That's good enough. We'll read Stewart.
Thank you, sir.
Matters now under advisement, and we'll render a decision.
Thank you.